So, uplifting the heart. It's an interesting topic to reflect on in the context of Buddhist practice, because I think it's easy for us to get the impression, and I guess maybe I'm speaking more to those of you who are familiar with and maybe even steeped in it, as opposed to sort of coming for a first sort of exploration of, or early in your exploration of it. But it's easy to get the sense from looking at from the outside, or sometimes from actually being on the inside, that it's really got a lot to do with suffering. And it's a lot to do with, you know, the problems and the difficulties and the stuff, and somehow finding our way out of that entanglement. And, of course, it's really true that there's a lot of interest and concern in addressing the unsatisfactoriness in life. And yet, that doesn't mean that our exclusive attention is to be directed towards that realm. There's equally the need and the value that we recognize of turning our attention to what supports an uplifted heart, a sense of lightness, of joy, of delight even. And, you know, when we look at traditional images, I used to be, and well, I still can be, struck by how when you look at certain traditions, the sort of the exemplars, the great sort of practitioners of Sufism or Hinduism or various things, they're often sitting here with a great big grins on their face. And when you look at the old Buddhist masters, they're sort of kind of grim. And they mostly wear pretty drab coloured clothes and sort of don't look like they're having a lot of fun. And it can be a little bit sort of off-putting for some, and others it can be kind of like, oh, okay, that's how I'm supposed to be. We kind of think, oh, that's how you, that's the end of suffering. You just, you know, you stop feeling anything. Or something like that. And we can kind of get into a process of really working very hard for our freedom, for our liberation, for our release from suffering. And of course there is that element to it, but that's really not the element that I want to focus on today. So there's something about the way we turn our attention to experience that it's really important to look at, and that we're actually wired up very powerfully and compellingly to do, is to look for where the problem is in our life or in our situation. Look where the danger is, look where the problem is, and focus on addressing it. It's a survival mechanism, and you know, modern brain science and that is very clearly recognizing and acknowledging the fact that our system pays a lot more attention to danger or to discomfort or to apparent threat than it does to anything else. And that's, you know, useful functional adaptation. But in terms of our inner experience in our life, it's easy to be constantly locking onto and finding and attending to and attempting to fix or deal with or accept or be with, for meditators, the difficult things. The problem, the struggle, and not see that there's a larger picture, that when we can open to the larger picture, there's a more natural sense of balance and harmony that isn't in any way about denying or excluding or suppressing the difficult and the suffering, which is a pattern we can also see in some traditions and some approaches to spiritual practices. Like, let's just not go there. Let's always, you know, remember what we should be grateful for, appreciate what we've got. Don't, you know, think of the less fortunate. Sorry, do think of the less fortunate. Don't think of yourself. All that in a way that is a little bit disconnected and actually isn't helpful, isn't supportive to us. So there can be a sort of a, almost like a relief for many of us, I think, when we hear, oh, yeah, let's actually acknowledge the suffering, the difficulty, the struggle, the confusion, the tragedy that's sometimes there in our life, in my life, in your life, in the lives of others around us and, you know, many far distant from us. But in that, it can sort of be like we get into this process of, okay, that's now the whole of my practice. That's what I'm here to do. And when I do it, when I say it, I almost feel, I don't know if you see, but it's like this, my body goes, I'm getting ready to, you know? And sometimes we notice in our body that the urge or the urgency that drives us into the kind of habitually disconnected and pressured life that our culture encourages us to adopt in order to maximize our production and consumption, essentially, it encourages that, we translate that kind of orientation and attitude into spiritual practice, which is really not concerned with maximizing our production or consumption or anything like that at all. But somehow we carry a similar sort of a tightness in to a whole different mode of being. And then if we're not careful, that habit of mind colonizes the territory. And we end up kind of involved in what becomes spiritual materialism. Like we're using our practice to try and get somewhere or to become someone better or different than we are. And actually that's premised on a sense of not being okay with what we are and where we are. And that premise, if unseen, if unquestioned, is really, it's like the plug hole down which the joy of our life just gurgles. You know? They just get a little brook. And because we're busy doing something about it, we don't even notice that it's there. It's often unseen, unquestioned. At least until we enter into spiritual practice, in which case we're very likely, and other forms of practice too, to bring us into contact with that sense. So joy and uplift in a sense of what we love and what we appreciate, what delights us, it's something really important to include. And in the path of practice, you know, it's not something that we get at the end when we've done it all, we're finally liberated. Wow, okay, now I can enjoy myself. No. It's very much part of the path. And you know, the Buddha in his teaching included joy, rapture, uplift as one of the seven factors of enlightenment, of awakening, of the qualities that in their maturing and their convergence leads to the freedom of the human heart. And yes, there's concentration and there's effort and there's sort of, we could say, sort of really working in a sense, but there's also this quality of joy, and together with it a sense of sort of curiosity, often translated as investigation. I was reflecting on the factors of the path of the path in the context of the factors of awakening, and how the translation for what in Pali is Dhamma Vichaya is usually taken as investigation of the Dharma, looking at the way things are. And I was just thinking, investigation, what sort of things do we investigate in our life? We investigate crimes, we investigate tragedies, we investigate scandals. You know, what sort of things do we investigate? There's already an orientation in the word for most of us that there's a problem, I've got to figure out what it is so I can fix it. And that's what investigation seems, you know, here's suffering, I'm going to figure it out, and then I'm going to fix it. And already in that, there's a sort of heaviness. And another way to translate the word, and one that I find more useful, is actually curiosity. Curiosity is the quality that brings forth a natural inclination to explore, to investigate, to see, that comes out of a sense of not yet fully knowing and understanding what's going on. Children have it in abundance, at least early on. And we still have it too, though sometimes a little further or a little deeper under the surface. And so in terms of the path of awakening and the factors of awakening, seeing that actually joy and uplift and curiosity, which is one of the factors understood as being an uplifting quality, an energizing quality. These lead to awakening. And so important to understand how it comes to be, how they are brought about. That our condition is not in our control is clear. This is one of the sort of expressions that we understand as, you know, suffering or dukkha or unsatisfactoriness. We can't make things be the way we want them to be. And our condition is subject to the influence of conditions that we may have some ability to choose. And so the simple thing of going and moving my body, when I do it, I notice that without moving or sitting here, I might feel heavy or a bit dense or a little tired. Now, I can't say, okay, feel bright and feel bright. It just doesn't happen like that. I can't do it. But I can go and I can move my body. And then there's some brightness, some aliveness, some... And it's like, oh, so I can't control it, but I can influence it. And in that, there's a counterbalance to the sort of, in a way, the surrendering into the helplessness of I'm not in control, but with the, oh, actually, but that doesn't mean that I can't make a difference. Something really important in that. We can make a difference. And there's a, again, for me, there's a sense of uplift in that, oh, possibility. Yeah, this whole path is about what's possible for us to awaken. To know a joy that isn't dependent on the presence of the lovely or the absence of the painful and the difficult. A different order of joy, a different order of uplift than one dependent simply upon our experiences or what we're in contact with around us, what we're in contact with within ourselves equally. And so we're involved in the process of developing, of cultivating, of connecting with, of discovering what's possible for us as human beings. And this possibility, this potentiality is vast and mysterious, worthy of our curiosity. And kind of important as I'm speaking about this to check in and listen. Is there any way in which you set that apart from yourself as a possibility? Are you saying, oh, no, he's not really talking about me. He's talking about somebody else, those, you know, great practitioners of old, or the really keen ones, or the really good ones, or the really somewhat different than me ones. You know, do we make those conclusions habitually? Do we think we know? Because what I'm not saying you have to convince yourself that it is you, and it will be you, and it's going to be you, and before the end of lunchtime, hopefully. But maybe if you just leave it open in the realm of don't know, that, well, maybe not, but maybe. Who knows what could happen? Again, for me, there's a sense of expansion and lightness that comes with that, don't know. It's open here. It's open here. So, seeing we have this tendency to pick out and locate and focus on what's difficult, what's problematic. How newspapers sell much more when there's some extra bad news. Really, it's good business. And we kind of have this tendency to want to be fixing the problem. To find the problem. And always to be looking for the problem. And even if there isn't really one, we're probably sure there's going to be one soon, so we better find it, so we can deal with it when it gets here. And living in that condition, again, it's like a... There's a loss of brightness, of aliveness, of openness, of fulsomeness, of tingling, as someone said after the exercise. The tingling of aliveness. So... There's lots of ways to look at and to respond to this. One way is to really attend to what it is that we find touches our hearts, what we like, what we enjoy, what we appreciate. Appreciation as a practice. Incredibly powerful. And to allow ourselves to be touched by that which touches us. I brought a few things with me for this day long that I don't normally bring. And one of them is this. And I love it. You don't have to, but I do. I'm going to pick it up so you can see. This is probably the physical item of material property I'm most attached to in the world. I found it in Buddh Gaya about 12 years ago after a long hunt for a bell that I loved and bought it from a Bhutanese monk. And there were six or seven of this model, and in Buddh Gaya, thousands of bells and bowls and bangs and bings and bongs. And I probably didn't try them all, but this one spoke to me in a way that none of the others did. And it's just a small thing, in a way. But I thought I'd bring it today, even though there's a perfectly lovely bell already here. And I thought I'd try something else as well. This I've taken with me before, but there's something I thought I'd try today that I've never before done in the context of sitting in the seat of the Dharma teacher. And there's a little context to this, in that it's probably not my strong suit, the topic of the day. I have the good fortune to be married to and living with someone who it really is, and I've learnt a lot from my wife on the topic. But this is probably not where I naturally find myself. And so it's been a place of a lot of practice for me. A place of a lot of practice, as I was speaking with my wife Catherine on just before I got here, and you know, she was saying, yes, your tendency is more in the sort of the earth and the ground and the solid and the, you know, all of that. And I think, yes, this isn't my natural territory, although through some fortunate coincidence it's actually the territory I've been encountering quite a bit recently. And we make up these we assign ourselves to these topics a year in advance or something. So, you know, one thinks of, I've got no idea where I'll be when I get there, but let's see. And it's not always as fortunate. But I had the thought, because when I say, you know, we kind of take on a certain persona and a mode. You know, one of the things I learned when I started teaching was you look around and see what everyone else is doing as a teacher and everyone else does as a student. I turned up to one of my first retreats in India not long after leaving Thailand, and I had this bright, red, flowery skirt, probably, you have to say. Well, you know, anyway, it was a very comfortable and I found it rather lovely item. And everyone else was wearing brown, grey, tan or white. Simple, plain colours. And it was like, whoops. We learn quite quickly such things. That was as a yogi. And sometime years later when starting teaching and, you know, talking with one of my teachers, and she says, yeah, she makes sure, you know, she takes all the makeup off and no jewellery. And now in the tradition, the thing about not wearing adornments, or in some of the precepts for monks and nuns to refrain from sort of beautifying, wearing garlands and scents and all that sort of thing. And there's a certain value and purpose in that, in terms of not trying to place true meaning and value in appearances, which it can't be found in, to be honest, it can't. And it's really important for us, particularly in our appearance-driven culture. And sometimes it's not about the appearance. It's about something in us that is touched by a certain quality that's represented in a something, whether it be the sound of the bell or something that we're wearing. And 2 or 3 years ago, I went into a charity shop, and I have something of a habit in that department, and sort of a significant chunk of my wardrobe born of that. I saw something in there that I just completely, my eyes lit up, I got all happy, and I thought, wow. And it doesn't happen very often, I assure you. I really spent a lot of time going, that old looking for something that you might like and it's not there. And anyway,
I failed this. It's not even quite my size. But I wondered to myself when I was reflecting on this, could I wear this here? And what would people think?
Great.
And so for those of you who this is your first time in this context, it's not always like this. But that's fine as a first place to begin. Because for me, it's completely not my normal mode. So I'm actually, in a certain sense, playing with myself, hopefully more than I might be messing with you by doing this. And I hope I'm not. And I'm not now starting to suggest that this is the way we're supposed to show up here. But it's really interesting, isn't it? It's really interesting, you know? I used to have a bit of trouble wearing this jumper, actually, because it just felt a little bit too bright. I really like it. In New Zealand, where I come from, it's made of possum fur and merino. It's really nice. But I used to feel it's a little bit too bright. And it's like, okay, so I've taken another step. And something is in, it's not just that it's very bright. It's for me that it's completely outside of my normal me, and there's something freeing in that. And that's kind of what I wanted to share more than, you know, wearing a brightly coloured, slightly too small waistcoat. So just take a moment and stop. Let your attention come into your body. You know, shield your eyes if you need. Don't have to. How does it affect you that I'm speaking in this way and talking about this? It may not be something you find that brings laughter. It's okay, and it's lovely, and it's fine. And it's really also okay if it feels a little awkward or a little edgy, because it can be. The whole thing of how we present ourselves in the world, how we imagine we will be perceived, whether we expect to be rejected or excluded or made different, or expect to be and hope to be included. It's a really major part of the territory for most of us. And attending to it skillfully, caringly, and wisely is a really important part of what allows our heart to find its deeper joy and lightness. To feel a sense of uplift. One might, and I certainly did, take a little time to anticipate what people's minds might do with this particular, quote, stunt or clothing. I even contemplated saying nothing about it and just turning up. And I thought, well, I'll actually explain this. You know? And it's okay if your mind's response is a bit bright, or, you know, we don't really need to go there, do we? It's okay to have that response. But turning towards the tendency to either judge ourselves or to fear the judgment of others for who and what we show up as. Something we really need to attend to. The idea that there's something wrong with me or you, in you, that we need to see the untruth of. We need to really question the foundation of and see the untruth of that assumption, that perception, which drives so much of our activity, that holds so much of our energy, and that isn't true. So much pressure we can place upon ourselves to improve, to fix, to get better, to be more spiritual, more kindly, more compassionate, more wise,
more mindful in the spiritual realms. You get into those kind of things. And we get trapped in the process of trying to fix and improve. You don't need to be trapped in that place. Just as with that process of tending to focus on what's wrong with the world, we equally tend to easily pick out what's wrong with ourselves or what could be improved upon and form great lists for our attention and our efforts. Spiritual practice can be all about that sometimes for some of us. And again, just stop and notice what's it like for you as I'm speaking about this. This is very different, has a different sort of feeling to it than sort of charity shop sort of antics. This isn't about judging or rejecting the fact that we get involved with that particular pattern of activity, or that for some of us it's strong and even seems to be dominant in our lives. But just really naming it and saying, oh, what if this wasn't true? Without having to say, hey, I'm okay, I'm perfect, I'm all right, nothing wrong with me. Because that's equally going to actually just be entanglement. But it's like, what if we leave it open here? What if we don't make ourselves into something that needs fixing? There's very little sense of joy, of uplift, of happiness in a mind and heart that is wedded to the sense of something wrong with me and all the efforts to try and resolve it and fix it and improve it, because they come out of that sense of something's wrong with me, inevitably reinforce it. The more we act on an assumption, even to change it, we reinforce that it's true in the first place. This is how our mind works. Because we're giving it validity by acting on it. Say, okay, I've improved something about me that I thought wasn't okay. If I succeed at that, I just find the next thing, the other thing, the many other things, it seems, that need fixing, that need improving. So, being aware of this tendency, being aware of this tendency in ourselves, and perhaps for most of us, it would be a skillful and appropriate practice to start paying attention to those aspects of our life, those expressions of our day, those qualities in our heart and mind that are wholesome, that are beautiful, that are in fact lovely and worthy of honouring and appreciating. Because our habit and tendency is so strong the other way. And again, it's not to suggest that it's all one thing and there aren't, you know, areas that we really need to attend to and work with in our lives. Of course, we have those. But because for most of us the tendency is so skewed towards that, to find balance, to find an accurate perception, a realistic view of what's true, most of us need to lean in the other direction. That makes sense. It's like, I don't know if you notice this, but my head tends to sit slightly off skew on my shoulders. It's been like that ever since I started looking at photographs of myself, so I guess even before then. When I try and make it straighter, like if someone's taking a photograph of me, I emphasize the off skewness somehow. I don't know how, but it's like, something in me thinks that it must be going that way, so it's got to go that way, but I think it's the other way around. And kinesthetically, I can't seem to untangle that. But basically, when we're used to leaning in a certain direction, if we come into a point of balance, it feels like we're going too far the other way. Always. So if you notice you have a leaning, the place of balance is going to feel like, oh no, it's going this way, but it's not. It's because the reality and the image are out of sync. And so with the tendency to lean into, oh, I've got to really look at all my stuff because, you know, that's what needs attention. If we start to find balance in honoring what's wholesome, what's lovely, what's beautiful in us, what's noble and precious in us, initially, and perhaps for quite some time, it might feel like, wow, I'm into some kind of self-grandiosity, blown-up ego trip, you know. And we're not. We're actually getting real. So I think I mentioned when I was here a year ago, I was talking about the paramis, the perfections, the qualities of heart we can perfect, that and the quality of honesty, of sakya. One needs to be honest with oneself about one's limitations, faults and areas for improvement, yes. But equally one needs to be honest with oneself about one's good qualities, about one's wholesome actions. And I reflected then that most of us would find it much, much easier to put our hand up and say all the things that we need to work on about ourselves and say it in front of this group of, you know, strangers or acquaintances for some friends maybe. But in this group, it would be much easier to put our hands up and name a few things that were definitely in need of improvement. We might even feel good about it, you know, it's like confessional effect. Than to actually put our hand up and say, actually, this about me is great. And I said, when I was talking about it a year ago, I'm not going to ask you to do that. That was that retreat. Let's see where we go with this one. So what would it be to give up believing our ideas about ourselves? Particularly the ideas that are framed in terms of what's not okay, could be improved, should be better or different or other than as you are. And again, just leave it in the realm of, I don't know. Not, I'm asking you to convince yourself that everything is perfect and peachy. You don't use that word here, do you? Peachy. Okay. Anyway, you know what it means. Mm-hmm. Just say we didn't know. To read you a passage. From a Hindu monk named Kelpel Venanji. And he, this was quoted in a book by Gavin Harrison, who's a Dharma teacher based in America called The Lap of the Buddha. That was the book this was quoted in. He says, Kelpel Venanji, the monk says, break your heart no longer. Each time you judge yourself, you break your heart. You stop feeding on the love that is the wellspring of your vitality. But now the time has come, your time, to live, to celebrate, and to see the goodness that you are. You are dear, divine, and very, very pure. Let no one, no thing, no idea or ideal obstruct you. If one comes, even in the name of truth, forgive the thought for its unknowing. Do not fight it. Just let go and breathe into the goodness that you are. Remarkable words. Break your heart no longer. Let go. And breathe into the goodness that you are. Coming to trust the underlying goodness of our hearts. So important. Not denying our mistakes, our confusions, times we've caused harm to others or ourselves that we might regret. Of course, we all have these. But to understand that really in the end we are endeavouring as best we can to live well. To find meaning and to contribute to life in whatever form or way we take that. And to support that, something about uplifting the heart, seeing what it is that brings us in contact with a sense of appreciation, of joy, of well-being. One of the Buddha's primary insights that really is at the heart, and there's a number of different ways you can approach this, but at the heart of what he was pointing to, was that the way we attend shapes the world. That there isn't an object of something out there which we are subjected to. The way we attend shapes the world. The world arises through an interactive process. What we call the world, which is sights and sounds, smells and touch and taste and form and our interaction with it. The way we give attention is transformative. Meditative practice, to a large extent, is about the art of giving attention skillfully. So we begin by just settling, calming, setting, just learning to be able to give attention at all. Because that's not always so well developed in us. And it takes time if you're new to it. And then, learning and seeing what ways of paying attention contribute to well-being, happiness and freedom, and which ways do not. So one aspect of paying attention that's important to develop is the paying attention to that which we appreciate, that which we love or we enjoy. And so, what I'd like to invite you to do at this point, so we'll have a little time for some walking meditation. And in that walking meditation, I'd like to invite you to be open to noticing what you might enjoy, appreciate, feel touched with or curious about, as another way it might happen for you, or interested in what's around you. Whether it be the people, the buildings, the grounds, the sky, the grass, the construction, your feet if you're looking at them or feeling them, somebody else's feet as they go past. Don't feel like you have to find something. Because it's fine if you don't. Well, you've got to find a good something or a better something than somebody else. Because it's really okay, whatever happens here. So, this is possibly adding I don't mean to add a layer of complexity to walking meditation here. Walking meditation is just to walk mindfully, feeling your feet touch the earth as you walk, knowing that you're present. Just as in the sitting meditation, we use the breath as the vehicle for that. We're just walking. But we're not really going anywhere. We're not doing anything. We're not producing anything of sort of future value. It's just for the value of what's in the experience itself. And see what you notice. Just by having had that invitation extended, see what you notice. And see for yourself how willing you are to really orient in that direction a little. Or whether there's something in that says, don't know if that's a good idea. Sounds all very well, but I'm not sure. If that's so, just notice that in yourself. You don't have to override it. But notice it. Become aware of it. So I'm inviting you over this next 20 minutes or so to turn towards what feels for you to be somehow engaging or interesting or possibly even uplifting or enjoyable. and see what happens. Don't try and get this right or do it well. First of all, don't try and do that with it. But just see what happens.